There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Eamon, you were born and grew up in Dublin, in the working class areas of Dublin. What was your childhood like?
Well, we had a one room. My brother and I, mother and father, all in one room. We didn't have electricity. It was a pretty modest, if not bleak, existence. In a rooming house, it was in a lower middle class area, which actually made it worse. Because if you're really poor and everyone around you is really poor, you're all in it together. But if you're very poor in a otherwise swanky enough area, you can feel that.
Okay, and tell me about something about your parents. Your dad, I think, was called Paddy, yeah?
He was, yeah. He was a builder's labourer when I was a child growing up. Very, very hard work, 6 day week. Fiver was the wages. If it rained, there was a thing called broken time. You didn't get paid. And it rains a lot in Ireland.
Yeah, to be fair.
He was a wonderful man, always in good form, good humour, liked a pint, but very happily married to my mother, who was a very religious woman, and regarded her vocation in life to raise her children and be a good wife, to provide food and sustenance and love, of course. Mm-hmm. Old-fashioned values by the standards of today. Some would call those values reactionary. My own view is that I was, and my brother, my late brother now, Kevin, we were massive beneficiaries of that nurturing.
What about school, Eamon? Because you've clearly arrived in your adult life as a man of, as we'll hear throughout, tremendous use of words and language, and you're a pretty clear thinker. So did you go to a good school, or were you a good scholar?
Yes, because we lived in that neighbourhood, and my mother wouldn't leave it, even for a house in a lesser place. Mm-hmm. She wanted us to go to that school for a reason. It was a very good school. I did really well in the school. In fact, Bertie Ahern, our former Prime Minister, went to the same school. It was just a national school. Mm-hmm. I was a very good scholar. Unfortunately, although I was, I didn't really go on. I won a one-year scholarship to second-level education, which is quite cruel, really, because in 1 year you get nothing. So it was a kind of a perverse Irish joke that the 1 year was up. I was 13, and you weren't legally allowed to work until you were 14. But I scanned the papers and I got a job as a messenger boy on a bike. That was the end of studying a formal education.
Yes.
But I was a voracious reader of my father's newspapers, of any books from the library. So I read an awful lot. We didn't have a television. We had a radio eventually, but there was no television. And of course, you might think, because we didn't have the gizmos and stuff that IT stuff that kids have today, that ours was a bleak and grey world. But I don't think it was. You had to use your imagination a lot more. We had wonderful comics, that we read. And I think probably it was richer in some ways for your, and more fertile for your mind.
Absolutely. You grew up at a time when in the Republic of Ireland, in certain schools, football, soccer, as they would have called it, was frowned upon. How did that work for you? Because obviously you were becoming a good player as well.
Yeah, it didn't become an issue because it only became an issue at second level, really. Uh-huh. But Liam Brady, for example, there was a ban in place. Any Gaelic sportsman who attended a soccer match, or indeed any Gaelic official, was banned from that organisation for life. That's how bad it was, how rigid it was. Great Irish Gaelic footballers used to wear caps and scarves and disguise themselves when Manchester United came to town. It was amazing, really odd.
But where did your love of football come from, Eamon?
I think we lived just opposite a football ground. My father was a Gaelic man. He loved the Gaelic sport, hurling in particular. I just came, it was something we played after school. It was something we read about. Charlie Buchan's Football Monthly was as close as we got. Wonderful pictures of people like Nat Lofthouse.
Occasionally colourised.
Occasionally, yeah. I mean, Stanley Matthews and Tom Finney. And we in working class towns, the cities in Ireland, soccer was the game. And we knew as much about it by reading about it and imagining, and sometimes getting to listen to it on a radio broadcast, a BBC broadcast, if the reception was good. I tell you a very funny story, Danny, about that. John Giles, who was a great player in the game, his father, he lived not far from us, and his father was a great football man. But John once heard his father and another man arguing about who was better, Finney or Matthews. This was the great issue of the time.
The great debate, yeah.
The great debate in English football. And they argued for an hour. And John said, at the end of it, it turned out neither of them had seen either Matthews or Finney play. So what they had this fierce argument. And it was all on the basis of the perception that Finney was more an all-rounder and could play centre forward and had 2 feet, and Matthews was just doing it on the right wing. It was just an amazing imaginary world. But I think it tells you a lot.
You were an apprentice at Manchester United. How did you come to the attention of that great club?
Well, they had a man called Billy Behan, who was a former Manchester United player and a friend of Matt Busby's, who was their Irish scout. He found Paul McGrath, he found John Giles, the late Liam Whelan, who died in the mm-hmm. Munich air crash. He was a very, very astute judge of talent, but I was the exception maybe. But he scouted me and sent me to Manchester for a trial. That was, I'd be there for 2 weeks and get to play one match in front of Matt Busby. 45 minutes of the match, Busby was there the second half, and I had the game of my life. It was like divine intervention. And I played much better than I ever played subsequently or before. And I signed as an apprentice, professional, which was like a dream come true for a young kid anywhere.
I mean,
in Ireland, you know, it was huge.
Incredible, yeah. And this is the days before Ryanair and that. When you left Ireland, and you were two days short when you went for that trial of your 15th birthday, and you
Correct.
Signed as a 15-year-old. What was it like leaving your home, your parents, your family, to go and work in one of the bigger institutions in England?
Yeah, it was for me, it was a dream.
Good.
I overcame the homesickness quickly, shockingly quickly, really.
Mm-hmm.
For my mother, it was heartbreak because I was her eldest son, and she was a woman who didn't have much time for England for historical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with England for historical reasons as well.
For hysterical reasons, yeah.
No, I did. I loved the English way of life, and I loved being just normal because for 15 years I'd been a standout poor kid in a sort of well-off area. So I loved the anonymity of just being in a group and having a go, and you'd get by on your merits. The worst thing about living in poverty and not being educated is the class system and the fact you're excluded from good jobs and the prospect of good jobs. Here I was, and if I did my stuff and I was a hungry kid, I'd be get on in football, and I love that.
You signed pro forms on your 17th birthday. Yeah. We'll talk about the football some more in just a second. And Barry Fry, who of course was one of your contemporaries at Manchester United.
He's my mentor.
Really? Then God bless you. Yeah.
He was my mentor. Yeah. He told me everything I know about women, gambling. And the meaning of life.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Talk to me some more about the social scene in Manchester, because in your autobiography, there's plenty about the football, but there's also plenty about being a late teenager in this massive city and having the time of your life, a ball.
Yeah, we kind of did. I wish I could have another go at it. I'd do it better next time. But we did. It was a very, very buzzy time, 1962, 63. The Beatles were coming along. We saw them play. There was Jimmy Savile had a club called the Three Coins in Fountain Street in Manchester. We went there. He also ran the Plaza Ballroom on Oxford Road, which was hugely. We saw Jerry and Pacemakers. We saw amazing bands. We saw them all.
The Hollies, Herman's Hermits.
The Hollies.
The Hollies.
The Hollies used to play in the Plaza at lunchtime for the office girls.
Incredible.
Where I met my first wife, actually.
And now, of course, and we have to be careful where we tread it, you can't mention Jimmy Savile's name in this country.
No, I know.
But he was a massive pop star at the time, wasn't he?
He was. He was huge. He drove around Manchester in a Rolls Royce in 1960, 61, 62. And oddly, ironically, there were rumours that he liked young girls and took them back to his flat, which was in Salford. But he was certainly among the people. And what subsequently happened would have been less a surprise, I think, to many people in private.
Of course, absolutely. And now let's say I mentioned that Barry Fry. I mentioned Barry Fry there just as he was your mate, but now I discover he's your mentor in all things, both football and secular. I'm delighted to say that we're joined now by another legend of the English game, Barry Fry. Hello, Barry.
Hello, Danny. Hello, Eamon. How are you, me old mucker?
Hiya, Barry. I'm great. I can't be doing bad. There's still. I'm on Danny's show. You told me if I kept working at it, I'd get there someday. So here I am. How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm still fat and happy, mate. There ain't many of us left.
Barry, we're talking. Eamon was talking there about you being his mentor in how to live in Manchester and in England. We'll talk about the football a little later. I'm not sure you're the best example, Barry, to be sure.
No, that's right. But we was in digs together. In fact, Eamon played for ERA against us in 1960, schoolboys. We both joined United. I think I was there 4 years. Eamon was there 5. Then he went to York. Then he went to Millwall, of course, for about 9 or 10 years, and he was magnificent. And when he was at Millwall, I used to go and watch him with my scarf and rattle in them days, and I used to stay overnight at his house every now and then. But he was a brilliant player as a young boy, Eamon, and... you know, he covered every blade of grass. I scored a lot of goals when I was there in the youth team, and Eamon must have made 95% of them. God bless him.
Well, it's important to establish, of course, that Eamon was a very, very good footballer as well. Because otherwise, I don't think people will put up with some of the things he says about other footballers on RTE these days.
Well, he always had a great opinion, Eamon, and he wasn't one to keep it to himself. And... I got in many fights, particularly with Wilf McGuinness. Nothing to do with me, but he was trying to batter Eamon, and I was the big partner, and I jumped in. And I if you talk to Wilf, he knocked 7 bells out of me, but I'd tell you a different story, and I knocked 7 bells out of him. But it was good fun. It was great days. Really passionate. People was committed. But Eamon was something special. He wasn't only a great footballer, he was also a very intelligent man.
We spent a lot of time at the dogs, Barry. We used to go to the dogs every night of the week. Didn't we, Barry?
Yeah, it was lovely.
For a couple of years.
I've got a Manchester newspaper, a cutting from a Manchester newspaper in front of me here, with the headline, Babes in the Betting Shop.
Yeah, Barry,
and,
do you remember
And you two
that?
Are both mentioned.
We did
I used to work in the betting shop. Gus Demis, I used to work in part-time, chalking the prices up. How about that? Because them days, of course, the maximum wage was 20 quid, and I never got anywhere near that. And in the summer, I used to work in the betting shop, chalk the prices up.
We did it together. It was amazing. And, of course, it was... just after betting shops had been licensed to be open at all.
Yeah.
And Gus Demme was the leading bookmaker in Manchester, and his son Selwyn.
Selwyn.
Yeah. They had this whizzo idea that we were always in the pet shop anyway. The guy said, "Why don't you chalk up the prices?" So we said, sure.
We did.
And he said, "But," he said, "come in tomorrow with your club blazers on." And we did. And it was the dream PR. And it was babes in the betting shop, as you say.
Yeah.
And Busby went mad. He went mad. He had it in, didn't he, Barry?
You, the boss had a quiet word at that time.
Yeah. So my impression, and I'm sorry to base it on sort of stereotypes, Barry, is that my first guess that you might not have been the ideal person to be a mentor turns out to be completely correct.
Absolutely spot on, Danny. You always was a good judge, mate. Yeah,
I know you, Barry. That's all I know.
I thought Eamon was a clean living boy when he come over. I soon changed him.
Barry, thank you very much for just giving a flavour of your friendship.
And you, Barry. And you too. Take care.
For a man who loves the language and talking, Eamon, I'm surprised you got a word in edgeways in your friendship with Barry Fry, but there you are.
Well, he was very much the leader. He was a big, handsome lad, and he had all the patter, and he was a Cockney accent, you see, and the Manchester girls went crazy for that.
They also went crazy a little later on for George Best, who must have turned up in the club while he was still there. Well, did you know George at all?
Oh yeah, I knew him very well. George came 1 year after I did, and he lived in Diggs quite close to us. He was very friendly with Barry.
Yeah,
And I think he played in 10 of Barry's 15 testimonials.
Yeah, contributes the most. Yeah.
He did, but I knew George really well. We went out together, dancing together, and he liked to play snooker. We played a lot of snooker in a snooker hall in Charlton, Temperance Hall, ironically, given what happened with George, the tragic end. But George was a lovely, quiet lad, and initially very timid with girls. But, of course, when he became a superstar, when he was 17, 18, well, then it was a different world. And I don't think he ever was able to manage the fame without the sustenance of drink. And this, you know, for anyone who knew George when we knew him, he was a lovely guy. When he was very famous and well off, he did a lot of favours for guys who'd played and never made it. And he'd go and play matches for them and do things for them. They were playing in non-league clubs and stuff like that. So George's life is a tragedy for football and for all of us who knew him, and I'm sure for football fans who feel very saddened by it.
Yeah, I mean the other character of Manchester United this time who I'd like to hear about it. I don't know how close the apprentice and young footballers got to Matt Busby.
No, Jimmy Murphy was Matt's assistant, and Wilf McGuinness, who Barry referred to there. Wilf was the youth team coach, and getting in the youth team for the Youth Cup, the FA Youth Cup, was a huge thing, a huge achievement, which happily Barry and I did. And we dealt mostly with Jimmy. Jimmy would be there for the youth matches. He'd be at reserve team, B team matches. Jimmy was the focal point and the go-to man. Very kindly man, football-wise, had huge influence. I think Bobby Charlton subsequently said that Jimmy Murphy was the person who helped him most as a footballer. And I know John Giles, for example, who I'm very friendly and close to now and work with, John would also testify, as would many others, to Jimmy Murphy's ability as a coach and as a football man.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Well, listen, you can tell us one more story about your time at Manchester United, I think, because you mentioned Johnny Giles, as we know him in this country, and Barry Fry's just been on. When Manchester United reached the FA Cup final in 1963, yes. I think the three of you set up some kind of business enterprise that perhaps didn't turn out as well as you'd hoped.
No, when they got to the Cup final, in those days, players were very badly paid anyway, but Manchester United were pretty bad payers. But when they got to the Cup final in 63, there was a tradition at the club. They would give the players 100 tickets, and the FA rule said 12, but they broke that. So the players had 100 tickets to dispose of. Now, on the black market, you could go to a car dealership in those days, get a top-of-the-range saloon car, with hand over your tickets. Deal done.
Wow.
John didn't want to do that, didn't want to deal with the spivs and scalpers. So Barry went to him and said, I told Barry that John didn't want to do this. Barry said, we'll take them off him. So we went to John and we said, give them to us. Barry really was the boss. I was just the messenger boy. Anyway, Barry got we got 100 tickets, or 90. And we'll get rid of them for you, John. And John was very decent. He said, look, anything over a grand, you can keep it.
Lovely.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
You know, John was on 20 quid a week. So off we went into town, and we're going around betting shops, casinos, dance halls, the plaza. We have 90 tickets. So a guy came to us and he said, how much do you want, guys? So Barry said, 1,500. Guy said, job done. Went back to his house. He got his checkbook out and wrote us a check for 1,500. We gave him the 90 tickets. The check bounced, and that was a year's wages for John gone. We had to go and tell him, and he was an absolute gentleman about it. It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, if we'd have gone to someone else, Bill Fowkes, God love him, he'd have killed us. But I had to live with that. And when I got my first cap in Paris, actually, two years later, the match fee was 50 quid. I offered it to John, and he didn't take it. He said, forget it. But it was a lot of money. He lost a year's wages. That was one of our little get-rich-quick schemes.
After several years at Manchester United, you moved on, initially to York City, though I think Birmingham City were also in for you. Why did you want to leave Manchester United?
Well, I knew I wasn't going to be good enough to be a top player. I wasn't strong enough. I had skill, but upper body strength and the things you need. And it was the era of Best Law, Bobby Charlton, John, you know, they had great players. So I thought I'd go, and I wanted to play first-team football. I went to Busby, asked for a transfer. He said, look, son, nobody ever asked for a transfer from Manchester United. I said, well, I'm asking for a transfer. It's no disrespect. I'd just like to go and, you know, start over somewhere else. So he actually did something quite unpleasant. I knew from Noel Cantwell, the late Noel Cantwell, that Birmingham City, who were then in the first division or top division, that the manager there, Joe Mallett, wanted to buy me. He was prepared to offer 8,000, which was nothing. But Busby sold me to York for 4.5. He didn't want me resurfacing in the first division and possibly embarrassing him. He had sold John Giles to Leeds, who were in the second division, and John did resurface to embarrass him to the point where he said that selling John was his biggest ever mistake. But Busby had that ruthlessness in him. I went to York and I was happy. I was in the first team. They'd just been promoted from Division 4 to 3. And I arrived at the ground. I was met by the club secretary, who was wearing a suit and a tie, and he took me through a little tunnel out onto the pitch, and there was a man on a lawnmower mowing the pitch.
I'm right.
And he said, that's our manager, Tom Lockie.
Hello. Welcome to the lower leagues now.
Yeah, and Tom was a delightful man, a Scot, tall, gentle Scottish man. He'd played at a good level in Scotland, and he'd played for York, and he was now the manager. He just got promotion, but he was still mowing the lawn. So it was very much upstairs, downstairs. And at that stage, as Barry said, I was, you know, very acutely aware of, you know, class and privilege or lack of. So I wasn't too impressed with the arrangements at York, I must say, or elsewhere in football. But that was just a very vivid little cameo.
Yeah. You went on playing for York, and in the mid-60s, you made your debut for the Republic of Ireland. The Republic almost qualified for 66, yeah. And you made your debut in the playoff against, of all people, Spain, to go to England for the finals.
We did, yeah. We beat Spain in Dublin. Yeah. They beat us 4-1 in Seville, so the playoff match was in Paris. But it was due to be in Highbury in London. And the Spanish were afraid of that. So many Irish, London Irish, and we'd get so many people there. It was like a home game for us. So they said to the Football Association of Ireland, if you come to Paris, you can keep all the gate receipts. So the FAI did that deal. And when we got to Paris, it was at the time of fascism in Spain, Franco, and there were hundreds of thousands of Spanish exiles in Paris. So the ground was packed full of Spaniards. They had Luis Suarez, who was the then European Footballer of the Year, great, great player. He played for Inter Milan. And I was playing directly opposite him. And John Giles played that night. We lost 1-0 to a goal scored about 10 minutes or 15 minutes from the end. And we gave a very, very good account of ourselves. Had we got a result, we'd have been in the 66 World Cup.
That's a beautiful exposition of the game itself and the importance and the failure to quite qualify for that tournament. But I think the build-up to the game was dominated by the delights of the city of Paris, because you've now promoted yourself from the delights of Manchester to the delights of Paris.
Yeah, unfortunately, a group of players decided to go to that lovely place, Montmartre, where all the girls were. About 10. And I followed like a sheep or a lamb.
Yes, more like that.
I told you I was mentored by Barry. Not much took place, actually. It was more like a scene from a comedy movie. It was appalling.
And yet,
but we did it. It was on the Monday night. We were playing on the Wednesday. It was kind of a bit of an eye-opener. But I think it was a response. The players were so sickened that the match should have been in London at their own mentors selling them out.
I'm right in thinking that you, several months later, you actually attended the 1966 World Cup final.
Yeah, I did. In fact, I attended the semi-final and the final. Amazingly. I think that day will stay with me. I think anyone who was in England on that day will remember it. And those great English heroes, that vivid image of Nobby Stiles. And Nobby is very, very unwell at the moment, and so many of them. Jimmy Greaves, that awful story we've seen recently of Jimmy and his bad stroke. Jimmy wasn't in the team, but he was in the squad and was a great English player of that period. The late Bobby Moore. These guys did something for England that will never be forgotten, and I don't think a lot of them had to sell their caps and medals because they hadn't got, you know, a few bob at the end of their lives. So I thought the Jimmy Greaves story was particularly poignant. I think the Sun wanted to raise 30,000. They couldn't get it. Very bad.
Well, I understand that Moose have has actually been sorted out, but the initial response in particular just makes you think, have we forgotten what these people did? Not for themselves, but for the country as well. Did you want England to win? You're from a fairly, how can I put this? Let's use the word. You're from a Republican background in Ireland. Did you want England to win the final?
I did. I had been living in England then for 6 years, and I loved English people. I really did. I liked their decency and their moderation, and I liked the country very much indeed. Mm. My mother was the Republican, really, in our family. Well, she came from a Republican background, but Republicanism wasn't very active in Ireland in the 50s and 60s. No. In fact, the IRA almost disbanded themselves. There was only a handful of them anyway. This was before the Troubles, which yes. began, of course, in the 60s, late 60s, and the civil rights marches. This is before that. So I did want England to win, and, you know, Bobby Charlton and Bobby Moore, I thought they were a wonderful side.
Yeah, absolutely. Your spell at York was short but sweet. Why did you leave York, and how did you end up at the place where you became a legendary footballer, Millwall?
Well, I was at York for 5 months, and I'd been hungry for first-team football for so long. I just loved it. I love playing. Even if there's only 5,000 people there at Bootham Crescent, which is the home matches, I just loved it. I played really well for those few months. And Millwall came and offered to pay twice as much as York had paid, which is about 8,000 or 9,000. A man called Billy Gray was the manager of Millwall, a wonderful man, played in the Notts Forest team that won the cup. And Billy took me to Millwall, where they had a really great side, wonderful side. They'd been promoted, and they were going to be, and I was part of the promotion, second successive promotion. Really, really good side, full of genuine Millwall legends like Brian Snowden and Tommy Wilson, and great characters. And I loved Millwall. I loved that part of London. The people, they were so passionate, and they were in the middle, of course, of an unbeaten run, which would end up breaking the Football League record.
I think we need to establish for people just how good this this team was. A team that went 3 years unbeaten at home, got promoted twice, and I often tell the story that I've been writing and broadcasting with Danny Baker, my only showbiz chum, yes. for the past 30 years. And occasionally, when we get wrapped around a few cold ones, we'll get to that place that sometimes men get to, where there's nothing else left to say. The reverie begins, and then he will then start to name the Millwall team of those late 60s. And when I tweeted out that I was doing this show with you, looking for questions, Danny said this. He says, just say Stepney, Gilchrist, yep. Cripps, Jones, yep. Snowden, yep. Wilson, yep. Rowan, Julians, Brown, yep. Dunphy, and Neil.
Yeah,
that side is legendary in South London. Talk to me about the side and how good they were, the people in the team, and also the relationship to Millwall's fans, who are, for better or worse, and we all know the story, themselves so much a part of the club.
Yeah, they were very, very vocal and passionate. And the old Den, the acoustics in the old Den were amazing. I mean, you would think there'd be only maybe 8,000-9,000 sometimes more, of course, when we were doing well. But the noise they made, and I think there used to be a saying, there still is in football, perhaps, that Londoners, Southerners don't like to go up north and play. Well, I'll tell you what, Northerners didn't like to come and play at the Den because we got stuck into them. With some terrific professionals. Brian Snowden, the late Brian Snowden, was the captain. Tommy Wilson, very good players. Harry Cripps, of course, is a genuine legend in that part of London. Harry was terrific, terrific fun. He was Barry Fry with knobs on, really.
Really?
In a good way. The day I arrived to sign for Millwall, he was taking his LPs out of his car. And I just signed that week, and he said, "Oh, Eamon, come here." He said, "Mike, come here, look at this." He said, 12 and 6, he said, "to you, special price." So I said, "Okay, thanks." I was going back to Manchester the following weekend. I saw it in W.H. Smith's, so 7 and 6. But Harry was a real character, sadly dead now. Barry Rowan was a wonderful footballer. Billy Neal is still at the club. Billy and I remain in contact and friends. A Scots player, terrific player. They were good, and the fans were part of it. And we were going for the record. I think it was 56 matches unbeaten. And the last five, the pressure was really on, and we needed the very last one, which Danny should know, but it was Carlisle. He'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Carlisle. And we went 1-0 down to a bloody good side where Chris Balderstone, who was a wonderful cricketer as well,
yes.
played cricket for Yorkshire in England, I think, and is dead now. He was their leader. And they went 1-0 up, and we crucified them. We nailed them to the floor in the last 20 minutes. Harry scored. The whole crowd went mad. That was the record done. I'll never forget that day as long as I live. And I don't think anyone who's in that ground would, because a lot of people had moved out from Bermondsey and from, you know, out to the suburbs, Catford and places like that. But they still brought the kids back into the old den, you know, back to their, what was the community and the where their roots were. It was very much a roots thing. Lots of people came from quite a far distance, from Kent and places, to go back to the den to see the lions.
I mean, and indeed, that side almost, in 1972, almost got into the top league of English football as well. Just missed out by a whisker.
Yeah, Benny Fenton, Billy Gray was sacked because he wanted to buy Rodney Marsh for 15 grand or 18 grand, which would have been the steal of the century. And Mickey Purser, who was then the owner and chairman, wouldn't give him the money. So Billy walked and Benny Fenton came. And Benny transformed the team. He bought really well. Keith Weller, Derek Posse, Barry Bridges, a new goalkeeper, Brian King, came. So he was able to, you know, oversee a transformation in the team, a transition from one group of players to another. Happily, I survived the transition. And we had a very, very good team. Weller and Posse were outstanding players.
Yeah, Keith Weller went on to play for England, of course.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Absolutely. In your time at Millwall, which, of course, covers most of your professional playing time, I think it's fair to say that the intelligence that Barry Fry referred to and having views about things outside of the world of football came to their own. I know you were involved with the anti-apartheid movement, but also you became the PFA official for Millwall, the PFA, you know, the representative, at a time when the PFA, let's put it this way, wasn't as powerful as it is now.
It wasn't, no. It had been very powerful when Jimmy Hill was the leader, and that's when the maximum wage was lifted.
Yeah, the George Eason case and all that, yeah.
Of course, in 1961. But it had, no, it wasn't very powerful, and no one really wanted it. The job entailed nothing more than collecting the fees, which was always hard work. And you never got them until the day before you were going to Manchester, which was always a Monday. So you'd have to catch the lads, you'd have to get them, almost get a gun out to get the subs. And then you go to Manchester and sit around drinking coffee. But Gordon Taylor was about 2 miles ahead of us. And there was a vacuum there, which he filled. They're powerful now. At least they're wealthy.
Yeah, well, they're certainly wealthy. That's undoubtedly the case. You went to your first PFA AGM with one Terry Venables.
Yes, I did.
On the train up to Manchester.
That's right. And I had played against Terry when he played for Spurs against us in a cup match, and I knew him and I liked him. He is very likable, personable, funny guy. He also had been a pop singer. He'd written a couple of books. I think he wrote a movie.
Yeah.
But when I started talking about football and reform and all of that, he said, give us a break, Eamon, you know. it's a jolly we're going on, you know. And we were on the train. He said, mother, listen to this old crap, you know, for 3 hours or whatever it took to get to Manchester in those days. So it was a kind of rude awakening. And when I got there, the atmosphere was very much, you know, let's have a bit of lunch and blah, and let's organise the next golf outing. But there were reforms that were badly needed, and the way young people were treated, the way young footballers who weren't going to make it were not educated. There were things that needed to be done, and as recently as what? We're talking about Jimmy Greaves just last week, yeah. And stuff like that still isn't done.
You were involved with the anti-apartheid movement as well.
I was, yeah. It was very, very shocking to think that in sport, apartheid in South Africa could determine the colour of a person's skin, could determine whether they could represent their country, was deeply shocking. The Basil de Oliveira affair was really shocking as well. It was very much an issue, apartheid, and I don't generally want to feel people should mix politics and sport, but this was different because the politics was coming into the sport, and apartheid determined that black cricketers, footballers, rugby players could not represent their country. And of course, in a wider sense, the apartheid regime in South Africa was repugnant to any notion of human rights. So I was interested. I did go on marches. I went on anti-Vietnam marches as well.
How did this go down with your fellow footballers and with the club?
The club didn't like it when they found out about it. The lads generally were fine because they knew I wasn't, you know, a poser. They knew I felt it. Mm-hmm. I genuinely believed it. I think if lads know you genuinely believe something, there's no problem with footballers. If you were going around preaching in the dressing room, well, then I think you'd get short answers. And you don't want to be telling lads what they should think. If there's ever an issue, all you've got to say, look, this is what I believe. What you believe is your business.
As I mentioned, in 1971-72, Millwall almost got promoted. I wonder if you could talk to me about the latter stages of the season, Eamon, because on the final day of the season, at the Den, there were 20,000 people at the old Den.
At least.
And I think they ended up with some premature celebrations as well, as so often happened in those days, that not all the games ended on the same day, and I think there might be some confusion about whether you were up or not.
Yeah, what happened was Birmingham were our rivals for the second spot, and they were playing away in Sheffield.
Sheffield Wednesday, yeah.
Sheffield Wednesday. And if they lost and we won, we were up. And people had transistor radios around the ground, and all of a sudden, with 20 minutes to go, we were 2-0 up against Preston, and the ground lit up, and everyone was cheering, and the message came onto the pitch, Birmingham are losing, so all we've got to do is hold on, which we did for 20 minutes. The crowd invaded the pitch. We were carried off shoulder high.
Yeah.
And it was actually Brian Moore. It was on ITV. Brian Moore was the commentator. This was amazing because Millwall, of course, the only London club never to have been promoted. And we got in the dressing room and Dennis Burnett had switched on the transistor. And the first thing we heard, and Birmingham have pulled the fat out of the fire in Sheffield. And Dennis picked up the transistor and smashed it on the ground in front of him. And we were devastated. So all they had to do, Birmingham, was go and beat Leighton Orient the following Wednesday, which was, that's as close as we came to the big time. And in those days, only two clubs went up. And we had a team that would have done well. We had a good footballing team. It was really, really sad. And sad for our supporters, of course.
The Republic of Ireland, we heard about you making your debut in a World Cup qualifier, but I think it's fair to say they were not the power that they've gone on to be in European and world football since then.
No, we never had enough good players. We had outstanding players. John Giles, perhaps the best of them. But Tony Dunn, left-back for Manchester United in the team that won the European Cup, as it then was in 1968. Tony was a brilliant player. Andy McAvoy played centre forward for Blackburn, leading goal scorer in the First Division at times. Pat Dunn, Manchester United goalkeeper. Noel Cantwell, West Ham, great player, Noel, great leader. Charlie Hurley, who was a big man.
Mm-hmm.
We were always short of two or three, four players of real quality, and it was very badly managed. When I started playing, the team was picked by what were known as the Big Five. They were five suits. And the manager...
Was it some kind of selection panel, yeah?
Yeah, selection panel. It was a bad, bad, bad idea. And they were picking the team. They always included one League of Ireland player who was usually way, way out of his depth.
I know that, and of course, while I understand the politics behind that, it's totally unfair on that person as well, isn't it?
I thought it was, but they didn't. You know, sometimes guys would go white. They were shaking, desperate stuff. In Dalyman Park, where we played the home matches, there was a holy water font, and they'd drink it nearly before they went out. It was unfair on everybody, really, but it was a bad gesture, stupid gesture. But some of the better players didn't often turn up. Don Revy, I know, didn't want John to be going anywhere near the Irish team because he was such a pivotal figure for Leeds. So hence I got 10 caps I shouldn't have got when John didn't show.
You did some. I mean, again, I'm using the word activism here with a small a. Your own activism meant that you were part of the little coterie of footballers who put a stop to the Big Five eventually.
Yeah, it's a very funny story, Danny. We hated it. We knew it was wrong. The manager should have the choice of player. So John, I led it. Started it. John was a powerful player. Alan Kelly, who's
great goalkeeper, of course, a senior man.
Preston,
yeah.
Yeah. So we went to them. We said, we're not having this. We're going to go on strike if you don't give the manager, who was then Mick Meagan, an Everton player and a very good player, if you don't give him the power to pick his own team. And the Big Five, eventually, after an 18-month struggle, were abolished. Of course, the next thing that happened was I was out of the team. So
Mick Meagan left you out, did he?
Yeah, well, he did, Mick, yeah. And this is a classic case of a turkey voting for Christmas. But it was the right thing to do, and it was quite funny. I can laugh at it now. I was crying at the time.
Yeah, I mean...
I couldn't start a campaign. Bring back the big fight. It didn't sound like a good slogan.
They were great, yeah. I hesitate to remind you, because I'm sure you know, of the 23 times you turned out for the Republic, you only won on two occasions.
That's right.
Which gives you some a feeling of where they were. And I mean, and I know...
Some of my former colleagues say there's a correlation there between my presence and defeat.
I mean, for Ireland to reach the latter stage of the World Cup tournament in the meanwhile, and of course, all the glory and controversy that's gone with it, even as talented a writer, you couldn't have sat down and scripted some of the stuff that's happened.
No, we had a golden generation of players. Paul McGrath, Roy Keane, Kevin Moran before that. Andy Townsend was really, really good player for Ireland. Dennis Irwin, people like that. We had one, Mark Lawrenson. Jack Charlton very cleverly got players who were qualified to play for us through their grannies, what called the granny rule. Ray Houghton, John Aldridge. So we had a wonderful team for a number of years, a really outstanding team. And that got to two World Cup finals, 94 and 90, and qualified for the European Championship in 1988. So this was heady stuff for us.
Indeed, and we'll get another time to talk about some more of that a little later on. I want to make as well the point here that it's during your playing career that your second career as a journalist and an author and broadcaster actually starts. It's not a heady start. It's something called the South London Press.
That's right.
And Dunphy's Diary.
That's right. I had acquired a reputation through the anti-apartheid stuff and perhaps agitating for communism or the Labour Party and a bit gone on anti-Vietnam protests as an unusual person. So. Mm-hmm. They decided they were Millwall. Millwall was our local team. So they said, would you write a piece every week? And I thought it would be a nice thing to do. They said, you won't have to do anything. We'll send a guy down and he'll talk to you and he'll go away and he'll write it up. So they sent the guy down and I had my doubts about it anyway. And the guy they sent down, don't like the look of him because I'm going to be saying things and there's going to be trouble here. So I better do it myself. So I said, I'll do it, but I'll have to write it myself. And they looked a bit dubious. I sat down at the kitchen table, and it took me 2 weeks to write the first 700-word column. I really grafted at it. And writing is hard work, as anyone knows who's done it, and especially short pieces. So I just did it myself, and it didn't go down well with the club because I talked about a lot of things that were wrong in football. By inference, of course, I was criticising my own club as well. But it was good for me. It was good training. It was good discipline. And I wrote a book, Only a Game, at that time.
You did write a book. And I'm sorry to interrupt. I shouldn't interrupt you, but I will. Because for those who don't know, listening to our voices doing this programme, Only a Game, which is a diary of, essentially a diary of one of Eamon's seasons at Millwall Football Club, I sometimes... blanch when people tell me that Fever Pitch was the first great book of the modern era of English football, because your diary and that book, Only a Game, is in fact the first of the modern kind of writing about English football. And I think if everybody had their own, that would be a truth more widely known. Advert ends. Carry on.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Fever Pitch is a great book. I did a reading, actually, with Nick Hornby in Charing Cross Road a very, very long time when he was launching it, and it was a wonderful and beautiful book.
Oh, no, absolutely, absolutely. But your book only is a game, out of history, yeah.
Yeah, it was only a game, question mark, and the question mark was important because it was after that near miss to get in the first division, as it then was, I was dropped near the end of that season, but I was full of hope for the next season. I said, why am I doing this? I'm 27, 28. I'm not getting rich. I'm not getting famous. So I'm going to chronicle the whole day from day one of pre-season. And it only lasted 6 months because I was sold at the end of 6 months. So it roughly was a six-month period of despair. It was Diary of a Loser. That was the only way I was only ever going to get published. They certainly weren't going to publish a book about my great highlights in football.
No.
So, but I just thought it was perhaps an antidote to the banality of so many football books in those days were ghosted, and they weren't very good. And they didn't take the football lover and the person who bought the book because they loved the player, didn't take them inside the world of football, which I thought was cheating, really. You really ought to, if you're going to write a book, do it right. So that's what I endeavoured to do.
And, of course, you got some advice about journalism, and I had no idea whether you were planning to become a journalist, writer, punter, call it what you like, but you got some advice from one of the great figures of British football in the middle part of the 20th century, the great Danny Blanchflower.
Yeah, Danny captained the Spurs double-winning team. He was a great player, had a great mind. He wrote a column every week in the Sunday Express, and it was wonderful.
Aha.
It was subversive, intelligent, skeptical. It was delightful, and he wrote it himself. And I kind of didn't know Danny, but I wrote to him, and I said, look, I played once against him in a cup match, but he said, come and meet me. And we met for some reason in Victoria Station in London, and we had a cup of coffee. And I said, look, I want to be a journalist. I want to do it. He said, well, you can do it, he said, but do it honest. He said, tell it as it is. Don't be afraid, because they'll try to get you. That was Danny's thing, you know. And, of course, they tried to get Danny. And Bill Nicholson wanted Danny to succeed him as manager of Spurs, and he'd have been a wonderful manager. Board wouldn't have it. Danny was an outcast. And even lots of players didn't like Danny because he was so unyielding in his convictions. But that was very good advice. It encouraged me because I had that kind of temperament anyway. But it was inspiring that he took the trouble. And we spent a couple of hours there drinking tea and coffee. And it was a valuable 2 hours, one of the most valuable 2 hours I ever spent.
Eamon, after your long stint at Millwall, which, as I say, has left you an indelible legend in that part of southeast London, you continue your career at first Charlton Athletic and then Reading. And actually, you're successful at both clubs, involved in promotions. Talk us about why you left Millwall and went to Charlton. They're very close together, the clubs, geographically, but they're not great rivals. The Millwall fans just don't take any notice of Charlton, do they?
No, absolutely. it's just sort of a quiet little backwater, and there's nothing happening there, or at least that's the way it was when I was playing. I went to Charlton. Benny Fenton, the manager, didn't really want me to leave, but I wanted to leave. I wanted to start again because I wasn't really sure to get my place in the team, and that was always the spur. Went to Charlton, where at first a former Irish colleague, Theo Foley, was the coach, and he wanted me. He'd played with me for Ireland. And then he got the sack, and Andy Nelson came. Andy had been a great centre-half in the Ipswich team that Alf Ramsey managed very successfully.
To win the title,
To win the title. And Andy was a big, hard, classic English centre-half, big, tough, strong man. And he did not like me at all as a footballer or as a person. Bolshy was the word he used. And we had an old Etonian chairman there who was quite a funny guy. He quite liked me, actually.
Michael Glickstein.
Michael Glickstein, that's right. And you had to call him Mr. Michael, which seemed to me, this is what, 70, 74?
Yeah.
73, 74, 75. I thought Mr. Michael in my ass. So, but he came to the matches, and Andy was a real heavy dude, and he would kick ass, no trouble. But when Mr. Michael appeared, Mr. Michael, he was Mr. Michael, this is Mr. Michael.
Suck up.
Yeah. I used to call him Mr. Glickstein or Mr. Chairman. Ah, my little commie friend. He actually quite liked me. He was an old Etonian. I think they owned Buckinghamshire or something.
Something like that.
There was no atmosphere there.
The fact of the matter is, the club, whatever else you say about Charlton Athletic, we have to remind people that it was in possession of the biggest club ground, never mind your Old Trafford's, the biggest club ground in English football. In the mid-70s there, I went to see The Who two successive summers, about the time you were playing there, and there were 75,000 people in the ground.
Yeah, it was vast. Imagine what it was like to play with 3,000 or 4,000.
Not good, I imagine. Not good.
I played for Charlton there against Brighton, when Brian Clough was the manager of Brighton. It's about the most memorable thing. And the other thing, Keith Peacock, who's a very, very good friend of mine. Keith was a wonderful servant to Charlton. And in the very last game of the promotion year we had, he dropped Keith, which was absolutely savage thing to do. He was an unbelievable guy, Andy, tough. But he was glad to get rid of me, and he gave me a free transfer.
To Reading.
Well, Charlie Hurley was the manager of Reading, and I played with Charlie, and they hadn't gained promotion in 50 years. And he said, I have a side, Eamon. They just need a bit of leadership. And no one had ever thought of me as a leader before. So I grew 2 inches and went to Reading. And Robin Friday was their star player, a brilliant player. But Robin would be popping pills and drinking, loved the girls. He was a big, handsome guy, legend, iconic figure now, a real iconic figure.
I mean, amazing book written about him. Yeah. And of course, the band, the Super Furry Animals, wrote a song about him, The Man Don't Give a... Tell us about
the
Robin.
Book was, well, the book was called The Greatest Player You've Never Seen.
Yeah.
And he was big, big man, huge. He had a big scar on his stomach about 9 inches long, where he'd fallen from an apartment onto a spiked railing. He was strong as an ox. He was asthmatic. He was great footballer, 2 great feet, good in the air, huge target man. He was fearless, and he was definitely the man for that team. But how Charlie said he turns up, get a hold of him, Eamon. So I actually liked him, because there was a bit of rock and roll in me. There still is. And not as much as Robin, but it was him and a guy called Minty Murray, John Murray, who was a very, very good player as well. And they were good lads. And I said, look, guys, we've got a chance here. And if we stick at it, if we work, we'll do the stuff afterwards. Let's get the game out of the way first. Mm. And we kind of worked on that basis and got promotion. But Robin was a fabulously charismatic guy with a heart of gold. And tragically, he died. He could have played at a much, much higher level. He could have been, you know, a top player. He wasn't quick, but he had every other thing. And, you know, I'm sure Reading people will never forget him. And we went up north, you know, to the Hartlepools and places like that. And Robin was fearless and a leader. Great, great guy. One of the most fascinating people I ever met. Very intelligent. Very into music and all of that.
Very sad, as you say, that only 38 years of age when he went from us. Promoted then, as you say, in 75, 76. Charlie Hurley, as you said, who had been a teammate in the Republic of Ireland team, amongst others. He left in unusual circumstances. Managers often resign after a game, but...
No, Charlie resigned at halftime. we got promotion, but he didn't really... There were a lot of dissent. The players didn't get the wage rises they expected. Reading at that time was a mean club. And Charlie looked after his directors as he felt obliged to do. But the players didn't forgive him. And about a couple of months into the season, we were getting hiding at home. And we went back in the dressing room at halftime. And he said, that's it. And he used some language that I'm sure Talksport wouldn't appreciate. He said, I'm out of here. He said, but first, and it was freezing, he said, you guys get back out on that pitch. And we had to stand there for 10 minutes.
Oh.
And he was gone. He resigned at halftime. And Morris Evans, a very nice man and a very, very good coach who was his assistant, took over then. So that was the end of my football career, really. He gave me a free transfer in August. This is August before. This is 12 months I was available for. It was the earliest free transfer in history.
There was also, if I might bring you back, in the middle of your time at Reading, there was another example of just how much the game has changed. When a local butcher made a fantastic offer to you all.
Well, he said, he'd been saying for years, if Reading ever get promotion, I'll give the lads a heifer, a bullock, or whatever
it is.
A cow, a bullock, free. And we did. We went to the mart. We got the thing. We patted it on the head. I have a lovely picture of Charlie assuring it everything would be okay. Took it away to this slaughterhouse. And then the following Friday, we were to go to the ground and pick up
the lovely steaks.
The T-bone steak, fillet steak, all the stuff. So we got to the ground. We got a little bag, small brown paper bag, full of mints. Mints. So we said to Charlie, we couldn't find him. So we said to the secretary, where's the steak? Where's the fillet? Where's the sirloin? Where's the T-bone? I don't know. He said, we don't know. We never got that. So obviously the directors of Reading, who were not exactly dying for a steak, took all the good stuff and gave us the mince. It was absolutely something out of a movie, but it happened.
And modern footballers would actually say you were lying if you told them that story now.
That's
of
a true story.
Absolutely. And you finished your career, if I might say, back in Ireland, the most beautifully named, if not necessarily the best team in Ireland, Shamrock Rovers.
Well, they are the most storied club in Ireland, Manchester United of Ireland, if you like. And John Giles went back there. We thought we'd build a kind of Celtic in Ireland, but we couldn't do it. I played for 1 year. We won the FAI Cup, which they had a great tradition of winning. I got my winner's medal, but I'd made my mind up. I was going to try to be a journalist, so I went off to do that.
With your playing days over, we can now talk a little bit, I think, about a career that's seen you a writer about football. And we'll come on to your other books a little later on, but a writer about football in the newspapers, and then on to a career on television, which, as I've been banging on here for many years, sees yourself, Johnny Giles, Bill O'Hurley, absolutely being a brilliant and revolutionary at the way you talk about the game. Talk to me about the writing first. I mean, because people will need to know that there are a lot of newspapers in Ireland, particularly in the Republic, and they take sports writing very seriously.
Well, they do now. We have some great sports writers. David Walsh is and Paul Kimmage are two of the best. But when I started out in journalism in what would it have been 78, the sports writing was very poor here, very very poor. And England was the place; it was much better. Sports writing in England was much better. It wasn't great in Ireland. It was also a closed shop, so I couldn't get a job. It was cash 22. Have you had any stuff published? No. Well, then you can't get a card, and you couldn't get a card, So
yeah.
It took me 2 years to break in. I started writing about soccer, and I was quite rigorous. I did my own thing, and I tried to be as good as I could be. Jack Charlton came along in 86, and Jack, the international team at low ebb, Jack inherited a wonderful team. Lawrence and McGrath, Ronnie Whelan, just
Ray legends. Houghton,
Ray Houghton, Aldridge, John Aldridge, yep. Great, great players. And he had them. Jack had it in his mind that he was going to a little island in the South Pacific where they'd never seen a football before. And he had Kevin Moore and all these guys. Anyway, he had them playing a Wimbledon style, and that's the way he stuck at it. And he was very successful, terrified, put foreigners under pressure. I remember a great Spanish team coming to Dublin and losing 1-0, and they went off the pitch shaking their heads. They'd never seen anything like it. Liam Brady was playing as well, and he ended Liam's career, actually. And Liam, of course, works on television with us now and is a brilliant analyst and was a great player. Jack just did it his way. I dissented. The country was delirious. When we qualified for the 88 European Championship and then drew England and then beat England, that's the day that everyone will remember until they die. And Jack was responsible. Even though we played lousy football, and this was a really, really top team, and I was the dissenting voice just through all of that, I was arguing the impossible, that this could be better. People said, what's better than qualifying?
Yeah.
I said, with these players, we should be more ambitious. But Jack became a national hero, and that was pretty uncomfortable. Test for someone writing journalist, and I was on television as well. But that, it kind of blooded me. It got me used to it. It certainly didn't make me popular.
No.
But I was lucky to have good editor in the Sunday Independent, a man called Angus Fanning, and in RTE, Tim O'Connor. And if you have good people who believe that you're doing it your way and the right way, and it's interesting, they'll stick by you. So I was lucky in that regard.
You were, and it is, as well as that writing, it is with the TV punditry on RTE that you've become, I'd say, one of the most famous faces, recognisable faces in modern Ireland. And the person, along with Liam Brady, that you do the punditry with is Johnny Giles, who we know has been a lifelong friend and supporter of yours from the days together at Manchester United. I'd like to say he joins us now here on My Sporting Life. Good evening, Johnny.
Hello, Danny. How are you?
Thank you very much indeed. Say hello to Eamon.
Hello, Eamon.
Hiya, John.
How's your head?
My head's in good form.
Yeah, well, he was actually speculating a little early off air, Johnny, about how your head might be this morning.
I'm okay. I'm okay. Just about. Yeah.
I mean, the two of you have been around each other for a lifetime. First of all, Johnny, let me ask you, because because you played for a top team and were in the Republic's team for a decade or so. Sometimes people forget what a good player Eamon was.
Yeah, Eamon was a real street player from the old days. He played, Landy Strait in the street as I did, and many, many other people. Good skill, good control. You had to, because we used to play with bouncers, what was called bouncers in those days, a rubber ball about twice the size of a tennis ball.
Yeah.
And much harder to control, obviously, than the big ball. So when we went to play with the big ball, we'd learned our trade, as it were. And Eamon was a typical street player. Good control, good technique, midfield player, and a real intelligent player, what we'd call footballers, real footballers.
Was there anything about the young Eamon Dunphy that would have led you to believe, Johnny, that this was a fellow who would go on to be one of the most respected and occasionally feared writers and analysts and broadcasters about the game?
Well, he always had a rebel streak. I met Eamon. I'm 5 years older than Eamon, and Eamon played for a team called Stella Maris, and he lived on Richmond Road, where the ground was situated. So he was there a lot. I think he used to spend most of his time at Stella Maris. So I joined Stella Maris a year before I went to Manchester United, and that's when I met Eamon. And he was very, very well known in the club. I think he was only 10 or 11 at that particular time. But when you'd be having a game of tennis and that, Eamon at times would nick the ball, take the ball, the tennis ball, and run away with it. So there was always a bit of a rebel streak in himself. but he was well known at Stella. He grew up at Stella. Then I went to Manchester United, and Eamon came to Manchester United 5 years later. So we've known each other a long time. Yeah. But Eamon was always a very bright, very, very bright lad. Self-educated lad, actually, then, and a great command of the English language. And he was, I think that's what's made him such a good broadcaster. He can debate anything, especially football, because he's writing, as we know. He's made a great career for himself, Eamon. I mean, he had, I think it was 9 years at Millwall. As you say, a very, very good, what was then second division team. He played. I played when he made his international debut. Mm. He got 23 caps for Republic.
He's told us he got most of those, though, in the days when you weren't available.
Well, I think that helped.
The two of you, for the last couple of decades, have discussed football on the national broadcast in Ireland, RTE,
yes.
The Premier League in particular. The flavour of the programme is that the truth gets told, whether it embarrasses important people or not, in a way that would just be unheard of, particularly on the BBC here in this country.
Yeah, I think I had the idea. I went in there in 1978, and there was a very good head of sport who had a background, actually, in print journalism, which I think was very important. And he was a huge character, Tim O'Connor. And he said to me, no one watches soccer on RTE. They watch it on ITV, BBC. I said, well, here's why. It's too bland, and you've got journalists there. You need football people there. And you need to be more rigorous in your assessment. And he had a great anchorman, Bill O'Hurley. He died very recently.
Very recently, yeah. Great loss, of course.
It was a great anchorman.
Ireland,
he was up there with Des Lynam, he had that touch. But he came from a current affairs and news background, and he was a newspaper man as well. So we got this journalistic vibe into things. We got anybody spouting banalities, we got them out. And we tried quite a few. I won't name them ex-footballers or footballers. And they just weren't prepared to call it as they were seeing it. What we were trying to do, Danny, was create a situation where you talk in an animated and passionate and truthful way about the game while the light's on. You don't go all sheepish when the lights are on and, talk in generalizations. You do that afterwards. But what normally I found happened was, as soon as the program was over, then people would tell you what they really thought.
Oh, ridiculous.
Let's get that into the studio was my idea. And I lived by it for a while, and I knew we needed John when this happened. In 1984, the European Championships were played, I think, in Paris, in France. And yeah. Platini was the man on everyone's lips, in everyone's thoughts, as a great player. And I'd watched him play against Ireland in World Cup qualifiers, and John had played against him. And John had said to me, he's not a great player. He didn't fancy when he came to Dublin. And John played directly against him. So I went into the championship with this in my head. Anyway, I laid down a marker very early. I said, I don't think France will achieve much. I don't think they'll win. I don't think Platini is a great player. And on I went through the championship as Platini went on scoring goals. Uh-huh. The worst moment, the semi-final. I said to the anchor, Bill O'Herlihy, today, Platini's going to be found out. This is a semi-final.
Against Portugal, I seem to think, yeah?
Was it? Yeah, yeah, he'll bottle it. Scored a hat-trick. So, I'm dead. I'm a dead pundit walking. Go on, limp onto the final. But funny enough, the press are having a ball. Everyone's having a ball. I can't go in the shop. And I meet John, who is in Dublin, for a drink. I said, John, was I wrong? He said, no, you were right, he said, but you shouldn't be saying it on television, Eamon. So I decided that then, I knew that we should get John, but John was media averse. He didn't like journalists, didn't like media. He was a quiet, decent guy, but he was the most wise person I think everyone in England knows now and knew it certainly when he was playing. He was most respected for his wisdom, knowledge. I said to Tim, let's get John, and Ortiz resisted. John came on the programme, and there was the antidote, and he added wisdom, a sense of proportion,
yeah,
and it strengthened the whole thing, and that's when it really took off.
Eamon is quite right. When I was in management, I wasn't very, very good with the press or to the press, because I said my obligation was to the players, and I never wanted to imply any criticism of the players. So I got a reputation of being very, very cautious, mm-hmm, and not being very, very friendly to the press. And Tim O'Connor, who was a good pal of Eamon and myself, the head of sport that Eamon mentioned there, was very reluctant to employ me because they said, well, John's not going to say anything. Well, the thing was, I was out of management then, so I was free to say what I wanted. Eamon pressed for me to go on. I knew there was a reluctance, and I more or less told it to clear off. It went to the last minute, but anyway, they put me on. But it was only because Eamon insisted that I go on. And before I went on, I must say, Danny, I always had a clear picture of what I wanted to say when I was free to say it.
Sure.
Because in my career, I played with and against great players. But what I found in the press generally, everybody was a great player, because nobody would really say, Joe Bloggs is not a great player. And I felt I had an obligation to the players who were genuinely great players to say it. And I would say if there wasn't. And between Eamon and myself, we actually told the truth in our own different ways, because I felt I had an obligation to the game. Eamon felt the same. We had an obligation to the game to tell the truth.
I've got a few quotes here in front of me. I could choose from hundreds, but just for fun, I'm going to throw a few of them at you. And just to give people a flavour of the way you sometimes talk on the television, more so, I think, than in your writing, which is, by definition, a little bit more controlled. Harry Kewell played for Australia, played for Leeds in the semi-final of the Champions League. Here's you. He's fat and he's a clown, Bill. A fat clown for all to see.
What are you? I wasn't a big fan of Harry's, actually.
Nah.
I thought Liverpool would have won that match. Did the Champions League final he played in?
Yeah, he did.
We marvelled at Harry's survival in English football, given how little he contributed.
Absolutely. Mick McCarthy. He is one of the biggest whingers in world football. He's a bloody Egypt.
Yep, I said that.
Yeah, and you stand by it?
Well, I think he's done remarkable work at Wolves and at Ipswich. He was an awful whinger with the Irish team, mostly over me and other people criticise him. I think Mick's a good fella. He wasn't my favourite footballer because they dropped David O'Leary and played Mick. That was one of Jack's most controversial things he ever did. But Mick has done amazing work at Ipswich.
Yeah, and don't forget,
he's a good man.
And I'm taking these quotes. These quotes totally out of context. I totally understand that. The next one as well, I'm taking out of context because A, I know him and I know how big he is. On John Hartson, this is while you're analysing a clip of him in action. That is not the arse of a £7 million player.
I said that. I'm sure, and it wasn't.
Yeah. Okay. And although he is a good lad as well, John Hartson.
Oh yeah. No. Absolutely.
And just to show that you're an equal opportunity person about this sort of stuff. As recently as 2 weeks ago, you called Louis van Gaal the much venerated and venerable manager of Manchester United, no less, a total spoofer. What did you mean by that?
Bullshit. Actually, I said the anchor said, "What do you mean?" I said, "He's a bullshit." And that was the night they beat Bruges away from home, I think 3-4 nil.
Yeah, well, Rooney got a hat-trick, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, I think time will show that Louis is a master of talking.
Yeah, he's already getting on the nerves of the press in this country, and that's usually the thin end of the wedge for people.
Yeah.
During your long and distinguished career as a writer, you've written several books that I'm interested in. And perhaps the most unusual of those was the fact that Paul McGinnis, the manager of U2, at the height of their powers, asked you to write a book that became titled Unforgettable Fire, The Past, Present and Future, the definitive biography of U2. That was, obviously, you say you're a rock and roll kind of guy, but that was a departure for you.
Yeah, he asked me if I'd do it. He said the band wanted me. They didn't know or like soccer, but they used to read my soccer stuff in a paper called the Sunday Tribune at the time, which was a highbrow version of our Sunday and the Sunday Market here, like the Guardian. And they liked the way I'd write about soccer, made them interested, made them want to know more. So they thought, will you do it? And they were huge, of course, at the time, just before Unforgettable, before their breakthrough album, which was
Joshua Tree.
Mm-hmm. And I researched it in the 2 years before that, and I couldn't give it away to a publisher. Then the Joshua Tree broke. They were on the front of Time magazine, and I was able to sell the book and make a lot of money. And it was very, very interesting. Bono's a very interesting guy, and they're very interesting people. But I have to say, I was more rock and roll than they were, because they're good boys. They don't do the throwing the television out of the window stuff, which is I probably would have liked a
would
bit
have preferred
more.
A bit more of that. He's such an enormous figure still in Irish public life. What do you make of Bono?
I like him. I think he's very bright. I know him well. I see him around the town. And the people think he shouldn't be mixing with George Bush and Tony Blair and going to Davos and places like that. And I have mixed feelings about that. You know, I think probably cultural icons like Bono should be outside throwing rocks. But him and Geldof, who I really admire, they're best friends. They think it's better to be inside the tent working the room than outside throwing rocks. So, you know, that's an argument you could spend a long time over. But personally, I like him.
You're also the biographer of another person who divides opinion, not just in Ireland, of course, but virtually everywhere he puts his foot, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Roy Keane. How did you come involved with Roy?
His manager, Michael Kennedy, or his solicitor, asked me if I'd be interested in writing his autobiography. I was amazed, and I felt it was a privilege. Nice to be asked. I'd always written about Keane, the same as everyone else, as I saw it. But some of the papers here when he was a young guy were savage to him, because he had a rock and roll period as well, Roy, you know. Got into trouble. But I liked him. When I met him, I liked him. He's very charming, very charismatic guy. But, you know, in recent years, I think he's been tiresome, to be honest. We did our stuff. The book sold, I think it was the second biggest sale of a sports book in Britain ever. Only Dickie Bird sold more. He's a very compelling figure, but I think he's lost his way. So I went from being a fan to not being a fan.
And just purely on a piece of football analysis, obviously he had that season at Sunderland where they got over 100 points and the team was absolutely flying.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether Roy could translate all of that inner fire, let's use that word that he has, and even overcome his difficulty sometimes with relating to other people and turn it into and being a great football manager, because there's no formula. And I'm not sure that he's going to make it.
No, he won't, I don't think. I think he inherited there a team that had just come down with a lot of Premier League players in it. And then when someone like him arrives, it's charismatic, the whole thing took off and some of the fans are great. But for the long run elsewhere, and I've talked to players who've worked for him in clubs, and it's not a good story. And it doesn't respect people. You have to respect other people if you want them to work for you. So I don't think he'll ever be a manager. He may prove us wrong, or may prove me wrong. I think he's sad. Man, he should celebrate what he's achieved in his life. He's got a beautiful wife and five beautiful children, and you know, they're good people, the kids. They live here, his parents. They're good people, and he's been a good man in many ways, and a great, great footballer. So I hope nothing bad happens to the guy, but he's become tiresome.
We should talk as well about Ireland now, because that's where you are. And it's been interesting over the past this qualification tournament for the Euros. We could talk about Irish politics if you want, but no, the Republic for the first time in a long time, the Northern Ireland team shows some sign of life. And I mean, I think you know Michael O'Neill from the days at Shamrock.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, he does not have a brilliantly talented bunch of players there, but he's got a fine team.
Yeah, he did some analysis with us during the World Cup last year. He's a terrific guy, knows his football, and he's done. It's actually a miracle that he's achieved what he's achieved with the squad of players he has, and he deserves massive support and a big job. He's a really good, a nice man, very sharp, knows his stuff, and I hope he gets A. I hope they qualify, and B. I hope he gets a decent job out of it. Michael Neal's a top class man.
And we're you know, people may be listening to that any time, but we're doing this also in the run-up to the upcoming Rugby Union World Cup.
Yep.
The rugby team in Ireland, and for people like myself, you know, one generation away, is a real focus because it represents the whole island. And when I sometimes put this, to people involved in Irish rugby, they're often very reluctant to talk about that. But I think it's one of the reasons why it has become so popular on the island, and why the team means so much abroad as well.
Yes, it's an all-Ireland sport, and they have had their golden generation of players, Brian O'Driscoll being, of course, the most famous of them, but Sexton, Paul O'Connell, they're great, great players. We have great hopes that they'll get maybe to the semi-final of the World Cup. We don't know, maybe a little bit further. Great coach at the moment, Joe Schmidt. So I'll be watching it, everyone in the country will be watching it. And it is, along with golf and Rory McIlroy and, you know, Shane Lowry, rugby and golf and, of course, hurling are the great sports here at the moment. Not, unfortunately, soccer, but we don't produce street footballers anymore. They're all indoors playing with their gizmos.
The Republic of Ireland could follow the same road as Scotland. They aren't very careful for the exact same reason.
Yep.
And finally, I noticed on the most popular television show in Ireland, the Late Late Show, recently. Now, whether you were being tongue-in-cheek or whether you're not so entirely happy with what you're seeing, the Republic of Ireland has done over the last 25 years a great job of selling itself to the world, the Celtic Tiger and all the rest of it. Then there was the recession. And you described the country using a tremendously Irish word, if you don't mind me saying, as a kip. Are you not happy with the little green country?
I think we don't know how to administer governments in this country. We've had a succession of very bad governments since the foundation of the state, actually. And most people here would agree with that. Wonderful charm and of the people. Beautiful country, as you know, Danny. It's in your blood. And the people are delightful. But the political class everywhere around the world now, I think, is despised. But they deserve it more, perhaps, here than they do anywhere else. I suppose English people would say the same thing. The good thing is we don't have a right-wing fringe or, you know, but they're just bumbling incompetence.
Well, I think for me, I mean, as an outsider looking in, a very interested outsider looking in, what I don't understand is how at least in England, in Britain, the political class is somewhat separate from the business class. They're both troublesome entities.
That's
Ireland,
very important distinction.
But in Ireland, they're absolutely overlapping. There's nothing in the Venn diagram. They're just the same people.
They all went to school together, Danny. And they're married into each other. And it's, you know, it's like they have the stuff and we're not getting any. And the health service here, we don't have. We don't have education. We don't have housing. There's a homeless crisis in Dublin City as we speak. So the ravages of austerity are still being felt here, and it's very sad to watch in this building I'm sitting in, this junkies and stuff outside. It's terrible.
Well, Eamon, it only really remains for me to ask you where you are in your life today. You're a 70-year-old person, still with clearly all your faculties and a great deal of fire in your belly. Have you any unfulfilled ambitions, and are you a happy man?
Yes, I am a very happy and very fortunate man. I have four grandchildren, and yes, I am very, very fulfilled and happy. I'd like to write two more books, one the second part of a memoir, and one a novel about our friends in the political business class here. Have to be a novel because the laws of libel are very, very severe here. And that's what I'd like to do, and maybe work for a little bit longer. I think work is good for you. So I'm very happy, very content, very lucky. And when you consider I was a journeyman footballer, and I'm very proud of that. I'm not ashamed of it. I think it's a great thing to be. Worked at it, worked hard. So I'm happy. I've been very lucky.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening. And make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and Spotify for more top Talk Sport content.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.